What's that? Welcome back to another episode of Afoot, a mystery genre podcast. I'm Glenn Fleischman, the regular host of this fine establishment where murder most foul happens on a regular basis. It's kind of creepy, but, you know, like Jessica Fletcher, you got to roll with it. You don't always get invited to weddings, but hey, some corpses show up. We cope. Joined by four fine individuals this week from mostly from my neck of the woods, Pacific Northwest. You can tell by the accent, right? Probably not. Jean McDonald, hello and welcome.
Hi, Glenn.
Got Katie Lane on the line. Hello, Katie.
Hello.
Susie Steffen, hello. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Glenn.
First time on the show. Thank you for being here. And also Shannon Sutter. Shannon, thanks for checking in with us.
Hello, darlings.
Hello. This episode, we've all joined to talk about something that is, I find, a near and dear topic, the Miss Fisher's Murder Mysteries, which are, Woo-hoo! That's the TV show name, but we're talking about the books that came long before. I think the books date back to the late 80s, if I'm remembering the copyright.
1989, you are correct.
1989, yeah. And although they're written set in the Flapper era, and boy, the author, Cary Greenwood, keeps popping these things out. And so what we decided to do, dear listeners, so if you're worried about spoilers, but we're trying to find out more about Miss Fisher and the series, we're going to start by talking more generally about Phryne Fisher and the books and the series, just kind of like what she is like as a character, what we think about it, our experience with it, where she fits in with the writer and the character with other authors and detectives we like, and then we'll go into more specifics. We'll fire off the spoiler horn and talk about three books, Cocaine Blues, Murder at Montparnasse, and the third one is the one that I'm forgetting. It's Murder in the Dark.
In the Dark.
The most generic title. One of my kids is walking by. I checked out some other Miss Fisher's from the library. He's like, do all of these involve murder? Like, yes, they all have a murder. In them, not all in the title.
Australia's a big place, man. There are lots of people to get rid of.
It's true. It's a violent country. It's actually fun if you know people in Melbourne, which I do via Twitter, to compare notes to them because, you know, it's filming all over town when they're making the movie. They take over part of the city. And then we'll talk about the first season of Miss Fisher. There's mysteries. There's three seasons, and the first one parallels the books a bit before it gets kind of off to its own thing. And so we'll talk about that. So if you're looking, listener, to hear general stuff, listen first, and then I'll put chapter markers in that you can find in the podcast or listen for the old spoiler horn, and we'll start talking details. So if you don't want the books, the specific plot points spoiled. So I've forgotten who suggested this. Was this Shannon's topic idea?
Yes, this was my topic idea. Yes,
I'm going to let you go first then, because I only read the books at your suggestion for this. I loved the TV show. When did you find out about the books? Are you a longtime reader?
No, actually, I heard about the TV show first. I'm a Johnny come lately to Netflix. Only started watching things on Netflix like in the last couple of years. With other TV shows and other original programming that they were showing. And, you know, I noticed as I picked a couple of other mystery shows that, you know, Miss Fisher Murder Mystery sort of ran across my screen. And it was something I had heard about here and there in the general internet conversation, but knew very little about it. Thought about watching the first one, and then I don't remember how I found out that they were based on a book series, but when I did, I was like off to the library because I'm one of those people who wants to read the book first or read the source, whatever the source material is. If the source material is a book, I read the book first. If the source material's like a movie or a TV show, I'll try to watch that first. I like to watch things or read things as they're created. So I have spent this last summer since about April or May, just going back to my library and asking for the next one to be put on hold and reading them kind of one after the other. And once I finished that in late July or somewhere, then I started watching the show. And I have watched up to the last episode of season three. I'm kind of holding off a little bit. I've been spoiled enough to know how how it's left. And I'm not quite ready to deal with that. So I'll leave it at that.
Oh, spoilers for us. I've only watched up to episode, I think I've watched the first episode of season two, and I haven't jumped back into it because I was a little shaken by the end of season one. So we'll talk about that when we get to the show. But you're very brave. So you've left yourself one last episode to watch.
Yeah, although I feel better now since you briefly mentioned a minute ago, as the day we record this, the news broke that the producers of the TV show are looking to set up a series of movies so that there will be more of Ms. Fisher coming.
And a potential television spinoff that picks up when Franny is 18. And apparently just around the time that her family has inherited their wealth and she is at finishing school.
Oh, yeah, so that's going to divide, too, from the books. We can get to that later.
Right.
Let me ask you, how many people watch this show when you watch the video? Do you watch it with subtitles on?
No.
My wife and I, my wife is deaf in one ear but has a hearing aid. Mm-hmm. I have pretty good hearing, and I love an Australian accent. And we actually regularly turn the subtitles on. Our local PBS station has the subtitles are paid for by Acorn Software. Somebody, I forget who.
Yeah.
And I'm like, thank you. Thank you for doing it. Because the first episode, I'm like, are they saying Franny? What are they saying? I haven't seen your friend. So we sometimes, and Bert Friday. Particularly, has got a pretty good Australian.
Yeah, that's called Strine.
Strine?
Strine.
Franny Strine.
Yeah, well, Bert anyway.
That's great. It's great. I mean, it's a very authentic show. You know, they shoot all those things in Australia and New Zealand with people trying to do American accents. It's so great to hear a show shot in Australia with people doing their own accent. Yep. It's amazing.
With the accent thing, in the books, one of the techniques I like the best is how she spells out yeah, which is the Y-A-I-R, yeah. Mm-hmm. And after like watching the show for as long as I have, reading it at the first time, I was like, "What the?" And then I thought of how they talk in the show, and I was like, "Oh yeah, that actually makes total sense when you add the accent into it when you're not thinking American."
Oh yeah, you can hear it in your head. Mm-hmm. We should give so those folks who are out there. I think it's a little hard to avoid because Ms. Fisher, the show got enough attention that I think most people have heard something about it. I was still asking folks about, I came to this, I'd watched the series because people had told me I'd like it. And I thought, well, you know, it's a period piece that's written now. And I don't, it's in Melbourne. Like, I like Australia, you know, all these things. I'm like, I don't know. People kept telling me I'd like it. And I totally fell in love with it. And how other folks, do you have any stories about coming to the show? Are we all like recent converts, or has anybody started reading? Did anyone start like 20 years ago when the books came out?
No, I just started reading based on us deciding to do this podcast because, I had the same thing with Netflix. It kept popping up, and I also subscribe to Acorn, and Acorn, you know, it's one of their most popular shows, but. And I'm obviously here on this podcast. I'm a big fan of mysteries and detectives. So I was excited to try something that I hadn't, I just hadn't made the leap. There's something about the way it's portrayed in the little cover art or whatever they call that on Netflix that made me think that just looks a little too foofy for me, like the lady with the pistol and the, oh yay, lady detective. But yeah, so I'm brand new to it, and who I've been on podcasts with before know, I'm more of a hard-boiled mystery fan than these don't, well, we could talk about where these fit in exactly, but this kind of amateur detective, lovely lady flitting around and solving mysteries with the force of her personality. Well,
indeed.
Let's just say I was never a big Miss Marple fan, so I wasn't sure.
A lot of people, though.
She does. Yep. She has a gun, so at least she has a gun. There's and there's a lot of blood. Some of it's pretty gross, actually. This show.
Yeah.
Maybe that's what happens when you move Miss Marple to Australia and make her a little bit younger. And anyway, so yes, I'm new to it.
It reminded me a bit of the Rex Stout novels, the Nero Wolfe, because although you know, charming in a very different way, but a bit of like the wealthy person and you know, who had a in the books, Wolf had a not a wealthy childhood. You know, it's often Montenegro, I think, is where he's from. And so you have this wealthy person sort of ensconced and doesn't really need to be solving crimes, but something about crime comes to them. For Wolf, it's a way to make a living. For Phryne, she needs some kind of, you know, motivation, some kind of, you know, something to do with herself that's good, and she remembers her upbringing. But I like the books themselves. The show is a little different about this, and it gets worse in season one as it goes on. But they're kind of the bloodless murders, right? Things that happen in the book are pretty... Not always, you know, a few of the ones I've read, actually several now. I read the three we were talking about tonight and now a few others. You can read them without that sense of like real gore, like I said, with a couple exceptions. But I've always thought that's kind of a differentiation in mystery novels where how elaborately the murder is presented so that you can smell it as opposed to just kind of like, and someone gets stabbed and they're dead and they're now off scene and that's over. there's somebody, Susie, can I tap you? Do you want to explain who Miss Fisher is? Give a little...
Sure. Well, let me just first say that I checked back on Facebook because as Glenn knows, I post a lot. And I went through my activity log to see when I first mentioned Miss Fisher, and it was an Instagram picture from February 8th, 2014, when Eugene had an ice storm. And yes, and I started watching Miss Fisher on Netflix. And then my next post was a couple months later when I discovered that all of the ebooks were on the late lamented Oyster. Yeah, the Netflix of ebooks. And I think I calculated that I made all of my money back for a year of Oyster just through reading the Miss Fisher books that month.
Well done.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, hence I killed it. But so Phryne Fisher, the honorable Miss Fisher, or I guess Miss Phryne is her title. I'm an American, so who even knows? But she's English, and how did she come to be in Australia? She's English, yeah. Well,
I think it's a little confusing. The narrative is odd because even in the first book, I think it's tangled. She's Australian, but they're of English origin, right?
Right.
And older brothers died off until her dad was the only one left to inherit a title back in England.
Right. It was like 73
people. So they started
in
Australia and then went to England when they suddenly struck it rich, essentially.
But she's like first generation Australia, is my impression. Like the father had wound up there because of misfortune or something.
Right.
Like
okay. Probably.
And then got pulled back. So she's kind of in different worlds. But so she lived in Melbourne until she was in her, I guess, early teen years, and talks about having no money, being, you know, skint poor, and then have this, you know, pile of wealth because of World War One. The pile of wealth falls upon the family, and off they go back to merry old. But yeah, so she maintains this household. This is the thing about the books that was amazing, having watched the show, is, boy, did they pare down the cast of characters for the TV show.
Yeah.
Budget.
What it costs, I know. It's like, I'm reading the books, I'm like, wait, there's another girl, and there's another butler. The butler's married.
The butler has a wife,
And then there's a dog.
Mrs. Butler.
But they did add characters, too, so, you know.
It's true.
That's true.
Aunt Prudence, who is in the TV show, is not in the books, as I understand.
No, I think she's a good addition, actually.
Yeah,
I agree.
There's lots of policemen in the books, too. There are tons of policemen. There's just two. I have this feeling sometimes watching the TV show, there's just like two policemen in all of Melbourne. There's not that much crime, I guess. So she's got a household. She's got a lady maid, Dorothy. Mm-hmm. She has this interesting relationship, which is much more chaste, obviously, in the books and less so in the TV show, which we could talk about the difference with Jack Robinson, who's a police detective. And they have a very good working relationship. And she's got Mr. Butler, her butler, and in the books, also his wife, who is dead in the TV show, very sadly. Let's call her. And then there's Cecil and Bert, who are taxi drivers, but also former wharfies, who are also communist red raggers.
Yes. I was going to say, good commies.
Right.
Good commies, yeah.
And they were diggers, too, Glenn. They
yeah.
fought in the First
diggers,
World War.
Yeah. Man, when I get, it's in the Montparnasse when we talk about them being in Gallipoli. It's like, oh, my God. And then they come back to not Avignon, whatever, the Armentier, and battles that if you study World War
I,
you're like, oh my God, these poor, you're like, I know they're fictional, but holy crap. Should we jump into the novels now? I think we've given people enough. This is whetting people's appetite, and we'll talk about specifics.
Yes, please. Right,
yeah. Sure.
I'm going to fire off the spoiler horn. Here we go. So somebody want to take the lead on talking about Cocaine Blues?
Well, there's some cocaine.
And there's some jazz.
There's some jazz. And you mix them both together, and you get a lovely little story. So Freddie is coming back to Australia, and she is traveling with the good doctor, McMillan. Am I remembering her last name?
Yeah. Yes.
Who's one of my favorite characters. It might be that she's a redhead and she wears trousers all the time.
She's a lesbian.
That's
I also
we can talk about that in the book about like the amount, like the sexual orientation. I mean, we should point out, people, I realize this is one thing important. I think I mentioned it briefly. It's a period piece, so they're written contemporaneously. As we were saying, they started in 1989. They all take place in the late 20s with flashbacks. But the sensibility, I think, is pretty, in many ways, is pretty close to the 20s. Like, I forget sometimes I'm reading something modern, but the, like, parts of the sensibility, but others, it's so, like, inclusive and, what's the right word? Like, it's a modern sensibility in terms of what people were actually doing then versus how people wrote then about what they were doing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think that's fair. Yeah.
So with Cocaine Blues, Franny is coming back to Australia. She's with the good Dr. McMillan, the out redhead lesbian in trousers, as we have established. she's being sent to investigate whether or not this young lady is being poisoned by someone, or if something is afoot. Whether she keeps writing these long letters home, this young woman, long letters home to her parents about her husband and how ill she feels. And so Franny has gone to Australia to investigate this in sort of a lark, and falls into a mystery over cocaine and abortions and poisoning and their Turkish baths and sex and tango.
Oh, Russian dancers.
Russian
right?
dancers.
Oh,
it's, yep.
Russian dancers. Somebody gets shot. There's fast cars and loose women. It's just wonderful.
It's a pretty great introduction to the character. I was when I first the first episode I watched, I thought I was like, oh, this is kind of, yeah, this is fun, this is interesting. Oh, it's really lively. What great characters! And then they launch into back alley abortions, and I'm like, okay,
right.
This is great. Wow, how are they? You know, and there was a woman I met via a friend on Twitter who she was keeping track of. She has a blog of abortion being presented in like. What's the right word? Not like a positive way, but like in a contextual way in TV shows where it's like presented realistically as something. Mm-hmm. And so I sent her, I'm like, did you know in the first episode? She's like, oh my God. You know, it's just like the first thing out. It's like, hey, there's this woman dying of a back alley abortion as, you know, early in the books. In the TV show, I mean, I think it's a little more, it comes even sooner, but that's going on.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, so sexuality is out front. Like, she's this very liberated 1929 woman who is just, it's just what she does. She has makes no bones about it, right?
Right.
It's what
she likes men. She yeah. likes yes. different kinds of men. And
so many, so many.
Yes.
The through line is that they're pretty and fun to spend time with for at least a very brief period of time.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's in the books.
Yes.
Yeah. The books are rather salacious. I was surprised by. I mean, they're not overly detailed, but it's actually. I was like, this is pretty good. Like, these aren't. They're the descriptions of sex are not embarrassing to read, which is great because you know how many novels are like, oh my God, don't describe. Oh, you know. These are like
where they describe sex in a way that you never want to have sex. Like, if that is sex, you do not want to have it. Franny actually seems to enjoy herself, and it doesn't become. What I really like is it doesn't become a plot point, right? Like, usually a woman is going to sleep with this man, and then it's, does he love me? Are we going to get married? Is this important? And it's really just, it's a thing that she does. When she enjoys somebody, she, you know, really enjoys them. But she's she's got a larger life. She's got a broader view than whoever she is canoodling at the time. And I appreciated that about both the show and the books.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the control that she exercises over her life, over, you know, who she's going to spend time with in general, who she's going to spend time in her bed with. She's going to make darn sure, as best she can, that she doesn't get pregnant. She makes no bones about the fact that she's got a diaphragm, which is at the time and in that place was illegal. It's so much, surprisingly so, compared to so many other mysteries or books in general featuring women. She is in control of her life and she refuses to let it go. And that's refreshing.
And there's a lot of really decent men also. Like, there's, you know, there's mm-hmm. Cads and Bounders, as there always are. We're introduced to Dot because Dot's going to stab the, which I don't think is in the TV version. No, she's going to stab.
Yeah, well, there'll be some fun comparisons when we get to that section.
Yes. But yeah, she's mad because she's lost her position as a, you know, a housekeeper kind of person because the boy of the house was harassing her. And then when she refused him, kind of put him off, he told his mother that you know, she was putting out or something, and she gets kicked out. And so she's waiting there to stab him, and when Franny comes across her and takes her on as a maid, because, you know, she likes her gumption, I think.
To be clear, a good Catholic stabbing,
right?
Not one of these Presbyterian stabbings that you hear so much of. It was very thoughtful and morally sound.
I think Dot is quite delightful, and especially because she has this moral center, but she kind of gives Franny a pass because Franny is at her heart ethical. So she's like, well, that doesn't seem right, but you know what she's doing? The thing that I found in the books that cracked me up is it'll be, they do, Greenwood does this really interesting, I think, point of view shift. I'm not sure that I've seen it before, where she'll be largely omniscient narrator following Franny around, but then she'll kind of shift to a little bit sometimes for, you know, just a paragraph, to somebody's point of view who's in the story. And Dot will sometimes be thinking, oh my gosh, she was attacked. Well, I hope she didn't hurt him too much. Yeah. Every time that comes up, I'm just like, her, she's like, oh no, you were attacked, Miss Fisher. How badly did you injure him? It's always like...
Yep. So I wanted to make a point about Dot, and that I don't think she gives, I don't think it's a pass. I think it's actually a really much more interesting characterization of somebody who is religious, and rather than just making them prudish and very close-minded, she makes Dot Greenwood makes Dot a full character who is looking at the world through this specific lens. And it's not that she's giving Franny a pass, it's just that she sees in Franny the good things that she believes in, and my point of view that Dot sees Franny as acting on those in a different way. Obviously, Franny does things that Dot would never do. They would not be appropriate in her mother's house. But I actually really appreciate that Dot is not a stock religious character who is to be made fun of, or, you know, who's so uptight that it's hard to relate to. That she's, and I like the same thing about Bert and Suss, that they are, you know, they're lefty liberals who are rabble rousers. But are like hearts of gold. They're not bad communists. They're, you know, they're good guys who are looking out for their fellow man and woman. And I really appreciate that Greenwood is willing to write her characters with that much nuance, and not just say, okay, you are these five characteristics, and we're just going to keep running with it. Because I think that's really easy in mysteries, in particular, where you fit them into a box and keep moving.
Well, I think maybe I'm wrong saying Dot gives her a pass, but she doesn't moralize at Miss Fisher. She tells her opinion of things, but she doesn't say, if such and such happens, I'm going to leave your service.
Right.
Which does come up. Which one is that? Is that the...
The butlers in...
Is that Montparnasse?
Montparnasse.
Yes, right. We can talk about that in a moment. But Dot is, I think, so impressed by the way that Miss Fisher lives her life so forthrightly, that even though it's not, as you say, it's not the lifestyle she wants, she doesn't seem equipped to, like, be, like, monolithic in her, you know, criticism. So I was reading one, there's a circus one, I forgot what it's called, but Blood and Circus or something. Yes. I was reading that one, and there's a bit in there where she makes her go off with a St. Christopher's medal because she's concerned about her. And Franny wears it because she appreciates the concern. It becomes a little, not exactly a plot point, but it's kind of this sweet bond between them instead of being something like, oh, I'll wear it if you make me. It's like, no, say your rosary for me. In this point where she's like Dot sitting there saying the rosary, she said, say the rosary for me if that makes you feel better, and I'll be back. And then she comes back, and Dot's been and saying the rosary. So it's kind of, it's nice. She respects Dot.
Exactly. Exactly.
She pays her well,
if you earn Franny's respect, she it's very hard to lose it.
Well, so this, I mean, so this particular novel, so we got all these overlapping strands, and I think it was a great introduction, but also it's like introduction to how many different plots that Greenwood wants to be able to pack into one thing. And I think she does a pretty good job. Sometimes I feel like there's a little too much plot, but I kind of like more plot rather than less in a murder novel. And it's not, we don't really have the drawing room reveal, but still it's like people trying to break into her hotel room. And then, oh my gosh, the whole business that was like Marx Brothers practically, with people sticking sticking cocaine in a bag.
Yes, trying to plant it on her.
Right, and her hiding it, and then her replacing it with like talc or something.
Yeah,
and then the policeman, she's like, everyone's going to strip. She throws all her clothes off and is naked. She makes them strip the policeman down. He's got cocaine or cocaine taped to his body that he has to explain himself. But it's like, you know, room service, please send up a bigger room. It's just, I don't know. But then the hotel manager is saying, you know, I understand this wasn't your fault, but if it happens again, you're going to have to leave.
Right. Which is why she buys a house. So,
yeah.
It was good.
Yeah. Well, obviously, what do you do when you might get kicked out of a hotel? You buy a house. I think what, in saying that, Glenn, it makes me realize just how much influence you can see in Greenwood's writing, how many different references points she has. There are other books where there are references to Dorothy Sayers and Poirot, and you can see that influence in the writing, but it doesn't stand out or take over any of the storytelling. So you don't. I didn't get the impression in reading any of the books, which was really lovely.
Yeah.
A bit of a change of pace that I was like, oh, you really like this writer, and so you're pretty much redoing their stuff, but with your slight spin. Greenwood's got a authentic voice that is it's unique, but you can still see the influences. They just don't overwhelm her storytelling, and I think that is also a feat in mystery writing.
There's the great thing in the books, too, where Franny, I think it may be in the later ones, where she loves mystery novels.
Yeah.
She's very, very unhappy with how bad many of them are.
Right.
That's a Harriet Vane, surely a Harriet Vane.
Absolutely.
So Murder in Montparnasse, we're jumping ahead a bit. It's number 12. In the series. Oh, wait, is that the next one we should talk about? Or Murder in the Dark is number 16. These were suggested, the titles were suggested by Shannon, which I appreciate because as good different examples of across the series. And now I'm going back and filling in and reading everything. So eventually I'll read them all. This is what's great when you find a new author and she has 20 books she's written in this one series.
I have a question because I have to confess I did not get to read this one, but I remember Shannon saying, you saying that this was the one that was as close to how it was made into
a TV episode. I thought this one captured the spirit.
Yeah.
This was the closest one like that captured the heart of the book in the TV show. This particular one is one where we get a lot of flashbacks and fill-ins of Franny's history. And we've heard mentions, I think, in previous books how she wound up volunteering in World War One, trying to get away from her father was trying to force her into marrying and settling down, and she was having none of that. So she ran off and joined an ambulance brigade and worked in the war on the front lines. And that's all we knew until this book, where we get through a series of flashbacks. What happened right at the end of the war. The war ends and Franny goes to Paris. And at first she's just recovering, trying to regain some kind of stability. with herself. And then what does her dad do? You need to come home. And she's just like, uh-uh. Right. And leaves the hotel and marches off to the other side of the Seine in Paris, to the left bank, and basically throws her lot in with the artists and the bohemes, becoming an artist's model and all of these things. And the flashback carries through to her first passionate love in René Dubois, as she is working as an artist model and doing all these things. And the book alternates between those flashbacks filling in all of this history with events that are coming back to Australia from here. This is where we get Bert and Cece, friends of theirs. There's a circle of veterans, and some of them are dying, and the guys cannot get anybody to listen to the fact that, yes, you know, our friends are being killed, and they go to Phryne for help. And she, of course, starts helping, when at the same time, friends from Paris, from her years right after the war, are also showing up, and it turns into this one giant mess of that, you know, sort of winds up bringing closure for Phryne of that portion of her life. Because we learned that René Dubois treated her, after he wooed her, he turned out to be abusive, treated her very badly, took her a long time to even think about, trusting guys again. She basically hid out with a whole group of lesbians in Paris after that for a while. And I just, like I said, when we get to the comparisons, I just felt that, this was, if not a perfect parallel adaptation of the plot, the spirit and the feel of the book for me really rang true between the book and the show with this one.
And this has got so many plot threads too, right? We've got the soldiers, the Bert and Cece, and they're in the book, I think it's, or in the TV show, it's three buddies. In the book, it's five buddies, right? There's seven of them?
Seven of them in the book, and two are dead. They cut it down a bit, which, that's what TV does. But
and then we have her Chinese lover, who's actually was born in England, but he's called Chinese. There's all this racism.
I mean,
good gravy. Like, I don't know the history of racism in Australia for sure. I barely, America is complicated enough to keep track of. But so you've got that going on, and her lover is going to get married. And so that precipitates the fight with Mr. and Mrs. Butler about whether they will leave the household, because they don't. It's not that they object morally. They don't want to pry into her affairs. It's that they don't want to have to testify in a divorce hearing.
Exactly.
Because it will ruin their reputation. They may not be able to get
it. Yes, they're automatically assuming that, Phryne would cause a divorce between Lynn and his new wife, when in the books it makes it clear that, Phryne is basically going to be his concubine and essentially sort of have first place, even though he's getting married.
Yeah.
So, and then, there's one. So then there's I'm already losing track, with the daughter who runs away from home? Or is that a different one? I think I'm confusing it with one other story. No, that's a different story. I'm sorry.
Yes, that's a different one.
I'm overcomplicating it.
Not a
problem. So it's the lover. There's the lover. There's Hugh Collins, the young police sergeant.
Aww.
There is a side plot where Hugh gets to go investigate, which is kind of neat.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, that's something that I really like about Cary Greenwood, that she tends to take the time wherever she can, here and there, to round out these characters.
Yes.
Jack Robinson starts out as just this, police detective that she runs into. But he, gradually we see that he's very capable. We learn about his wife and his family. We get to meet his wife later on. This is in Montparnasse is where Phryne does a good turn. Jack very embarrassedly asks, "My wife wants to go to the Lord Mayor's ball. Can you get tickets?" And Phryne's, "Of course, no problem."
She's so delightful to everybody. She really is such a delightful person. Her only negativity is for people who are trying to harm other people. She doesn't cut people socially. She reaches out. She gives money away, like water when she can, when it's useful. Mm-hmm. She runs into, there's like a Quaker do-gooder on the street, and she's like, she's dubious about him, then discovers what he does. Like, oh, here's have some money. Buy that person's lease off. They're going to kick her out. No, buy your money. Get that guy thrown out.
Greenwood takes care of her characters in a way that I think is stronger than a lot of authors that we see writing stories like this. But yeah, Hugh Collins gets a side adventure where he gets to shine in the end, and impress Dot and everybody else, which is kind of cute.
He does such a good job. Go, yeah, Hugh. Does, yeah. You just want to pinch his cheeks.
It's such a cinematic bit, which is not in the episode, in the TV mm-hmm, version.
Right.
It's so cinematic. Reading it, I thought, wow, that would look great on film, but they couldn't squeeze in.
No.
Frozen orange juice sales are being discussed. And, it's very complicated, but.
I do like that in the books, if you enjoy the show and if you come to the show first, and I know we're supposed to be talking about the books, but if you come to the show first and then you go to the books, I think one of the really lovely things is that they give a lot of room to breathe for those characters. Mm-hmm. Yes, there's a lot more plot, but there's a lot of room for those characters to just be, and you get to know, you know, to the degree that you, like me, over-identify characters when you watch all of the episodes as quickly as possible.
Yes.
When you get to the books, you feel like you're, oh, this is a friend that I know and I really like. And oh my gosh, there's so much more that I get to enjoy about them. There's so much more that I get to experience. And that is not... that's not very common for me when I switch back and forth between like something I found on television or a movie and then going to the books. It's not usually such a such a fruitful transfer.
How do folks feel about the Montparnasse novel in general? Given this is later in the series, I try to read this in order, so I think this was the second one I read as well. Thoughts about it as a work of fiction?
I think it's slightly crammed compared to some of the other stories. And I think in part that is because Greenwood is taking so much time in giving us this context for Phryne, her history. But as you said, it's still such a delight to read the fact that she is willing to put all this extra stuff in here and, you know, hope that the reader finds it as interesting as she does.
And I think that in Australia, as in England or France, World War I looms so much bigger than it does in the United States. And so this book, you know, she's been talking about Phryne's history as an ambulance driver a little bit in the other books. But this one really brings home why Phryne and Bert and Sess are so connected, you know, and why, I don't know, I guess what World War I did to Phryne.
Mm-hmm.
Although it's interesting, it's this late in the series where you discover, I mean, it's been hinted at, as you were talking about before, we're all talking about, but that she really finally bonds with Bert and Cease about this and their buddies, where there's that great scene where they're all sitting around and she's discussing stuff. And then she says that she was in the ambulance corps and, you know, and I forget the exact wording, but like the whole gang, she's like, suddenly she's not this sort of right. elegant patron feeding them, mm-hmm. helping them out. She's just one of them. And it just, that scene was beautiful to read. And then that changes, obviously, the relationship from then on too. The author doesn't forget that when she moves on.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
The Chinese lover plot is really fascinating too, because everything Phryne does is unconventional, right? And she doesn't care about it. She worries more about the effect on other people. So, judging by the context of the book, assuming it's historically accurate, which I think sounds right, it may even be too kind, it would have been totally de trop for someone to be engaged with someone from, of Chinese origin. And one of the earlier books, I think it was just earlier, and now that I've read some more, there's an explicit thing about whether if it came out more publicly, not just that she's doing this off to the side where everyone can ignore it, but if it came out publicly that she and Lin Cheng were a couple, even in, casually, that would actually ruin her socially. But she doesn't really care about that per se, but it is an issue. She considers it, and she doesn't want to ruin him and his community or his, business and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Right. I think actually, I'm not going to talk about the TV show. Never mind.
Alice B. Toklas gets a shout out in this episode. I just want to make sure I mention that. Or in this book. I like that. Gertrude Stein less so. Gertrude Stein featured less prominently in favor, mm-hmm. but Alice B. Toklas mm-hmm. does not get overlooked. How about going on to Murder in the Dark, which is the 16th in the series, I think is the number.
I think that's right.
That's right.
16. Mm-hmm. And that is pretty wild, Shannon. That is a very interesting one to pick because it's so different, I think, from the others.
Yes.
And it's so bizarre and wild and creepy and kind of cool. Like it kind of blows the top off. It seems like Greenwood had this car she's driving, which is Bronnie Fisher, and she's like, we're gonna take this up to 100 and go on the straightaway, see what we can do with this character.
This one, as I was reading it the first time around, and it has a very different feel. I mean, and it's not just the opulence of the plot. Basic plot of the book Murder in the Dark is that this young brother and sister, super rich, super high society, they are going to have the last best party of 1928, the New Year's Eve party to end all New Year's Eve parties. And Friday gets invited and she's planning to go, but Friday starts getting these warnings, including a live snake and a Christmas present, trying to warn her away from it, which, this being Friday, hell no,
right.
I'm going. But the over the topness that almost immediately the way that these two characters are basically throwing all kinds of money away. There's drugs everywhere. There's orgies going on. All of these things happening. And on top of it, it feels like this was Greenwood's dipping her toe into James Bond espionage style mystery versus traditional whodunit, because we have this guy who seems to be like a spy or an American spy or something on the premises looking for a master criminal,
mm-hmm.
And all of these sorts of things. And like you said, over the top, really, really over the top. Very, very different. And
competing polo teams and women with goats and fancy dress, lots of kinds of fancy
dress. And all female polo team too, as well.
That's right.
To combat. Right. And the reason I included the book when we get to the comparison stage is this, there's only two things I can think of that link the book to the movie. And that is a character name and the party setting that happens in the TV episode towards the end. Those are the only things that connect. Everything else is totally different.
Second season episode, right? It's not the first season episode?
Yeah, no, so it's end of the first.
I don't even recognize. It's hilarious. I didn't even recognize it.
It is. Yeah, it's the episode right before the last, as a matter of fact. And they tie those two episodes together. It's a continuation. Yeah.
Right. No, I've forgotten. Right. In the cup, but the couple is so unpleasant and it's so unsexy. And this is a very sensual book, and it's got, and it feels plausibly so. It's just everyone is like naked. They're having those orgies. I had to go look up. She used that term in the book that I can't remember. And I had to go look up and read about it. It's like basically like short of orgasm. Like, so everyone kind of gets themselves head up to a state where, but
almost
then they
there.
Don't.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. And it's like, and that's considered as kind of restraint. It's like a holier state than whatever.
It like Khazar? Something.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And
I'd have to look. I don't remember either.
It's a real term.
That said, this was my favorite of the books that we read.
Yes.
No, it really, it was just, just like you said, it's really fun. And it's really fun to watch Greenwood play with these characters that she's made and see, like, okay, what happens now? And I've watched all of the episodes, like we flew through them. We'll get to that when we talk about the television show. Anyway, so I've loved the television show, but when I went back to watch the episode that this book is based on, I was angry because the book is so much fun. Mm-hmm. And I was like, there was so much fun that you didn't have. Why didn't you want to?
Because you put in a story arc, which we will also get to when we
exactly
get to
the narrative arc, and then Jack.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I love me some Jack. We actually call, so I'll say it now and maybe ruin everything. But in the television show, we call the Franny and Jack tension the best unrequited lesbian romance on television today. Because Jack is just so, like, in the television show, in the books, he's this nondescript man's man. Mm-hmm. He's quiet and blah, blah, blah. But in the show, he's so pretty. And it's sort of like this weird little playful, interaction that we we think of it as a very like lesbian relationship when two friends like each other very much, but don't want to step on each other's toes. And so it's just maddening waiting for them to get together and realize it's okay. You can kiss.
Oh,
no spoilers there. That's just what we cheer from our couch
That's
as
right.
we watch.
Sure, everyone's dying to talk about the TV show. We'll put the marker. I'm going to sort of stick in the sand now. And actually, let me take, this is, I'm going to do our station ID, though, which is just a brief note to say, listeners, if you like Afoot, you can help us and the entire Incomparable Network by becoming a supporting member by going to theincomparable.com/members. And you can sign up to be a recurring member. You get special things like bonus episodes, outtakes, extra episodes, previews, bootleg editions, all kinds of stuff. And you can help keep these shows coming. It makes a big difference to us, even relatively small amounts of money, because it just gives us a little more freedom to hire out editing and be able to put the time into, because the recording part is often much easier than the other parts. And it's great to be able to have just a little bit of scratch to hire in help for that. So theincomparable.com/members, and you can check a box to say you'd like some of your membership to go to Afoot, and we will get a sliver of it, and that will help us keep these coming out on a regular basis. So thank you for considering and or becoming a member. And now on to the TV show. Everyone has thoughts. I'm going to back off. What are people's thoughts? TV show, free for all.
You mean like season one, free for all, right?
Season, yeah, let's talk about, let's not get into, I think just because I'm not sure how many people have watched all of it, I think season one's a good boundary because it has a complete arc.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Basically, I think this show, they obviously cared enough to do it right. Mm-hmm. We've mentioned that, you know, all the filming that happens on location, essentially, in Melbourne, in New Zealand, wherever it is that they're filming, that they're careful to try their best to get the look right. There's been a few times my husband's been watching, like, behind me when I've got it, and you'll see, you know, like, the newspaper, Wuxtry kid, but the backdrop behind him, some historical building, and that's obviously, like, green-screened or CGI'd
yes.
in, and, you know, it makes him shudder. But, you know, they're trying to immerse you, in the 1920s, the setting, the props, the costumes. Oh my God, Franny's
yeah,
clothes.
Yeah.
I want Franny's clothes
right.
so badly.
You know, I read something that they cost $1 million Australian for each episode.
For each
right.
episode, yeah.
Which is why we're looking at movies if
right.
we're going to
That's
continue
right.
the story.
That's right.
Yeah.
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 No, I bet. I mean, it's the verisimilitude that I think helps so much. Although there is like, there's one alley that I've seen a whole bunch of times.
Yeah.
There's that one brick alley.
Yeah.
Yes.
It
yes.
does a lot of duty there.
Like the yeah. Buffy High School, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Hallway.
Sure. I asked my friends in Melbourne, I'm like, how much of the town still looks like this? And there's like, and it's that there is this like little preserved areas so they can
yeah.
go in, but that's why we see the same thing over and
yeah.
over again.
Have you been there, Glenn?
Spots. I have not. I've heard it's a neat,
it's,
neat part of this.
It's
country.
Such an amazing city, and I wish I had seen Miss Fisher before I visited, because, you know, I would have been doing like a shrine, you know.
Right.
Like, oh, this yeah. happened here. And yeah, so.
Well, and, you know, I mean, we get to the characterization, but I think they cast it, you know, having read, and I like the show on its own merits before I read the books, and having read the books, I'm like, they cast it almost perfectly, unbelievably well in terms of actor capability and, like, even physically, I know I saw them before, but, like, I feel like I'm not sure my mental image would have been very different of any of the characters. If I had read the books first, I would have been like, those are the people.
Yeah.
I mean, even Essie Davis is so amazing. She's so perfect.
She's amazing.
I'm really yeah. glad they went with her. It's interesting because technically speaking, I think Essie Davis and the character of Franny in the TV show is like 10 years older
mm-hmm. yeah.
than the
yeah.
book
yeah.
Franny.
Yeah.
And I think that's one thing that improves that the fact that Franny is so supremely capable with able to do so many things. I mean, she's driving a car, she's flying a plane,
yep.
she's, you know, doing all of these things that, you know, somebody that would be, even with the war experience and even with the money, you still wonder slightly when somebody can do too many things perfectly. The fact that the TV character is a bit older, I think helps absorb that for the broader TV audience.
The only thing, I mean, I read the book first before I read Cocaine Blues first before I watched the first episode, and I did. Mm-hmm. I mean, I did have a younger person pictured, and I was more. I mean, there's something about making her older. So, I mean, they never say, but I mean, the actress is 40 something, right? Mm-hmm. That as opposed to a 20 something person, is that she really, you know. Certainly the sexual escapades take on a different twist to me, because if she was somebody who was in her 20s, or, you know, she's the character in the television show is clearly not interested in settling down and having children, you know, mm-hmm. and nobody expects her to. But if you're younger, you know, there's more. I mean, the character in the book to me is a little more impressive for her. True. Ability to flout the norms, because mm-hmm. she's flouting, mm-hmm. you know, her age, you know, what's expected of somebody at her age. So that's
a good point.
I mean, I love the actress, and I think she's, you know, she's beautiful to watch and everything, but that felt to me like sort of took away one, you know, as you say, she does everything perfectly, and really how could she do all those things, even as you say, with the money and the experiences she's had, so it's more believable that she would be a little bit older.
So true.
Yeah, and it's not like they even make a thing of it. She just, it's just a natural thing that the actress, when she started, I think, you know, late 30s or whatever. But, you know, the way she plays the character could be, you know, anywhere from 30 to 45. It's just, she's just her. And I like that the show doesn't make any kind of big deal about her age. She's just there. And it's marvelous that they did go a little bit older, I think, given that, you know, women, once they hit a certain age in Hollywood or other acting in the acting world, suddenly they have to take on different roles. And for once, mm-hmm. Essie Davis gets to play a character like Phryne Fisher.
Yeah, I think, I mean, you know, This show and this character are a phenomenon. I've been reading as much, you know, as I can about reviews, and just the fandom around it is incredible. And I think that's one of the reasons, is that, you know, there's a wide swath of women who can relate to the character, because it doesn't really matter what age she is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's cool to see also that I was actually thinking, even from before reading the books and understanding how old Phryne Fisher was supposed to be in the books, I was thinking they had the actress playing her young. And I thought also how awesome that they did this with a female actress for once, that I thought she was supposed to be younger than mm-hmm. what her obvious, you know, maybe not obvious, but her physical age, you could guess, was. And you should look up how old Essie Davis is. I thought it's a, you know, it's an acting challenge to portray younger, and they don't, you know, what's the terrible phrase, like mutton dressed as lamb or something like that is the thing. And they dress her superbly for herself. And she neither looks old or young. And, you know, in the books, I think it's a great thing. The amount of detail in the book about what she's wearing mm-hmm. forms such a wonderful picture too. And, you know, the TV show tries to keep up with that. And sometimes, you know, I can understand the cost, because they sometimes seem to succeed in putting her in as much different outfits like that. And so we know where they cut the cost. They didn't have as many actors and actresses involved in this. Not a whole police force, and only Mr. Butler.
It's not a whole household.
A little bit smaller. I'm trying to remember. It's just funny because I haven't rewatched the show. There's only Jane in the TV show, and there's Jane and
Ruth.
Yeah,
because she does appear in the TV show briefly, but they find
off.
They find a grandmother for her to live with. That's good. Yeah.
Right.
Well, and Jane disappears. I mean, sorry, that's.
Yeah, that's true.
She's like, she's at boarding school.
Right. To keep the cost, you got to keep those costs down.
Exactly.
But I, you know, I was reminded in watching
this. Maybe the actress had another role.
Exactly.
There's only so many actors in Australia, and they have to shift them around, you know, or they have to fly more people in. I mentioned the Nero Wolf earlier in terms of like the kind of stories they are, but I was very favorably reminded of the Timothy Hutton, Maury Chalkin series of Nero Wolfe, which weren't perfect, but they had an ensemble and they actually rotated people through. So there were a few people who were in recurring roles and others were like this cast of characters. So someone would be one week would be one of the murderers and the next week will be playing, you know, entirely different person in the show. It was great. But it had that sense of like, it captured this joy of like 1940s, 1950s sensibility. And those were actually written at the time. And this kind of the talk and the camaraderie, you know, the energy that the actors had, I feel like this captured it. Like the first episode, it felt like they'd been making the show for a long time because everything kind of snapped into place. They knew what they were mm-hmm. doing and it's only gotten better.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It was very enjoyable to watch. We were talking about the arc all along. And so this is something I know people have a lot of different feelings about is how divergent from the books and that creepy arc. I want to talk about the arc. Of it, other people's first.
Yeah. How do you feel about it, Glenn? Well, is it a good arc? Is it a bad arc?
The one thing that got me is my wife gave up on the show. We'd watched most of it and it started getting bloodier and bloodier. And we're watching mm-hmm. episodes. I don't know. Was yeah. an episode 9 or 10 where it's just gory on screen. My wife has a low I generally have a low tolerance for it. I do a little better. She has a very low tolerance and she's kind of like, I'm out. And I'm like, okay. And I watched the end and I'm like, oh, good news. The guy you thought was a pedophile was just a religious fanatic.
It's right. Okay. It's totally better. Totally better.
Yay.
That was the weirdest twist I think I've ever seen. It's something. Retcon the pedophilia out of the show.
Yes.
Huh. What other folks think about that? Maybe we should talk. Somebody could talk about the arc too. Like what was introduced, but what do you think about it?
I think it's just, it feels like it's the nature of television these days. I do a podcast about the TV show Babylon 5 back in the mid-90s, which I think was one of the first shows to really introduce the idea of season-long, or in that case, show-long story arc. And I think then, you know, Buffy the Vampire Slayer and other shows picked up on that, and it turned into a thing to have every season of your show, there's some underpinning story holding them all together. I don't know that it's a necessary thing. And I go back and forth, at least with Miss Fisher, because on the one hand, as I said, you know, the books themselves, you know, are great. And there's plenty of recurring characters and sort of recurring stuff in Phryne's life to hold if you need continuity like that, I feel like it's already in the books if you just want to bring it out a bit. On the other hand, I do like several of the things that the story arc wound up doing. It gave Phryne, it was a much quicker way to give Phryne a reason to come back to Australia. The book has like a couple of setup scenes where Phryne shows that she has a talent for being a detective, and that's why the set of parents in the book ask her to go back to Australia and find out if their daughter's being poisoned or not. And in the TV show, Phryne has just decided, I'm going to go back to Australia and I'm going to find out what happened to my sister once and for all. I like it, but I'm not sure it's necessary.
Yeah.
I think Phryne is a stronger character in the books. I think mm-hmm. she's a more interesting character. She's mm-hmm. I find her more relatable. I want to know more about her. I was actually, I loved the show and I watched the show first, but now having gotten into the books, I was kind of ticked off because I realized like, wait, there's this great character to know. And it was hidden under this weird, this fabricated, well, that's silly, it's fiction, this arc that doesn't need to be there and doesn't actually help make the characters better. Mm-hmm. I understand it makes television yeah. easier, but it doesn't make the characters or the story, at least for me, better. It's more efficient maybe, but I found Phryne much more interesting in the books than I found her in the television show. And that's saying quite a thing.
I think that happens when the arc comes in because she starts being, she's yeah. so afraid and she's so, mm-hmm. she's
it just undermines.
So, yeah.
yeah.
And maybe that's part of why they had to do it because the book Phryne is not 95% of the time she's calm, capable, and she's got this. TV, I don't think can believe it when a character does that. We can believe it in books. I think we can believe yeah. it in books, but we have trouble believing it in television. We need the main character to be at times not just in physical danger, but genuinely shaken emotionally in ways that, you know, that Cary Greenwood doesn't need to do in the books.
I mean, the creepiness of those last episodes was sort of intense. They were kind of interesting in their own right, although I didn't like the penultimate one. I didn't like, and the fellow, I'm blanking on his name, who's the chief villain there.
Boyle.
Yeah, I mean, he's not as scary as he should be for the role he occupies across the entire season. He almost mm-hmm. is like a Moriarty yeah. or like yeah. almost supernatural. Mm-hmm. And then it turns out he's just a very, very boring, messed up guy with some, you know, obscure knowledge of poisons.
Yeah, super yes. boring villain. Like, that was boring also villain. The thing. Like, yeah. You're a letdown, dude.
But don't you guys think that he was he's like, I think that the producers read Murder in the Dark and they took the mm-hmm. character of the Joker and tried to make Foyle the Joker.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
not I think as that's threatening.
Probably
the Joker's much better.
Yeah, but right. yeah. And sexier.
And the Joker doesn't have this, like, you know, twisted, complicated past that involves Phryne.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. and there's no Egyptian religion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I really do think that they felt like they had to have a male character that had, like, I mean, he ends up being a disappointment at the end, but up until that point, the way he is able to exercise power over Phryne and to do things where they think, oh, he's dead, or he must be, you know, and he gets in and gets to Phryne in ways that nobody seems to be able to stop him.
Right.
They needed a powerful character that was male
and something of a rescue. I mean, the truth is, you know, Phryne is the one who fights off Foyle himself, but Detective Robinson is there to catch her mm-hmm. when she falls. And mm-hmm. I think, and I will admit, that's a bit of the reason I can slightly forgive the arc, because of the various shippy moments that happen. but yeah, I agree. It's making Phryne a weaker character so there can be the excitement of a rescue, which TV demands.
I also think it introduces some of the vulnerability in the character that is interesting from Montparnasse. In the book, you see a lot true. More vulnerability in Phryne, and in similar ways that is brought out with the Foyle character in the television show. Hmm. They've again, it's a Foyle who is male and who is intimidating, who sets Phryne back on her heels in a way that we're not used to seeing. I just found the reason for the vulnerability, the storytelling in Montparnasse, the book, more interesting than the arc that is applied to television. But again, I understand it was the arc for the show was much more efficient because you've got limited time. You don't have all of those pages to establish things.
Speaking about the romantic part, though, bringing up Jack Robinson. So what do y'all think about the Jack Robinson arc? I was surprised because I didn't realize in the book, maybe later in the books things change. I don't think so, though, right? He's a happily married man to the whole
thing.
Yeah, that's right.
So, yeah. I mean, they set that's a secondary arc, is that his wife is maybe, you know, leaving and moving out and whatever. He does not have children apparently in the TV show either, right?
Right, so that's right.
It's a very different equation. But I mean, I feel like he's got such a smolder, the actor playing him, and great voice. And
I have no idea where they decided to do that first. If the producers decided that, you know, because at first they play with the idea of Phryne, you know, interested in all of these different men. It's like the first several episodes, she's, you know, got a different guy in bed every episode until she meets Lynn, and then she's okay with Lynn for a while, and then she keeps moving on, and all the time she's developing this this sexual tension with this detective inspector and I've totally lost my train of thought. Okay.
He's so handsome. He makes you lose your train of thought.
He's so pretty. He's so pretty.
Oh, he is. But no, and I remember. There was actually, I came across some blogs and stuff encouraging people to go leave good reviews on Netflix, because some of the initial review and reaction was slut-shaming Phryne for how dare she sleep around.
Yeah.
And saying, I'm not going to watch this anymore. All she does is sleep around with guys.
That's
and
the best part of this show. No.
I know. And that was the point of the people encouraging us to go leave 5-star reviews to counteract this spate of 1-star reviews. So, in the books, yeah, she all the way through, Phryne and Jack have a good working relationship. In the last couple of books, you know, there's a bit of flirtation going on here and there, but it's all in good fun. They're friends.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. he's got his wife. He's happily married. He's got, I'm trying to remember if he has kids in the book or just nieces and nephews.
They're barely mentioned. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's kind of like as a thing.
Yeah. So, yeah. Well, so there's kids in the books. Yeah. Happily. Yeah. You know, he's a happily married man. She has her happily living her life. And, but in the TV show, I can't decide. Did they discover Nathan Page and want to hire him first and then decide, oh my God, we've got to take advantage of this? Or was it in their heads all along to simplify things and do this?
Is it simplifying things? Because what I feel like it did was cut out one of their major potential characters of color and, you know, replace him with a white man. And I was like, I read the books, I got kind of mad at the producers. On the other hand, I think the books have some problems with racial characterization. So, you know, maybe that wouldn't have been great in the show either. But I miss Lynn. Like, come back, Lynn.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So, he's a very good character. And the TV show really doesn't use him to his full potential.
Yeah,
on the other hand, the TV show gave us an episode that dealt with the idea of the Maori, the natives.
Mm-hmm.
The native tribes. I don't remember that happening in any of the books personally. I may be wrong.
I think the boxing one does have
the TV
Australian
episode, yes.
Aboriginal folks, I think, not Maori, but
right. But I don't remember that happening in any of the books at the moment.
Since we're pointing out how pretty Jack Robinson is, I think it's worth noting, like, for a show in which ostensibly you have this very pretty woman as the lead character, she's Essie Davis is presented, I think, in a sexual light at times, but wow, do they have a lot of pretty guys in that show. It's really, it's not a female gaze necessarily, but it's a gaze that's open to a lot of people. Like, you know, I like a good looking guy. That's totally great. And it's like it was Sasha in the first, in the Cocaine Blues. You're just you're watching, it's like there's backroom abortions, there's, you know, cocaine. And then he's just like, let me throw all my clothes off. I'm like, all right, this is some action. But you don't usually see that, right? You know, the women are usually more objectified or presented in these forms than the men. It's much more even in more modern shows, and I feel like this was very liberating to see men presented not quite as objectified but somewhat as objectified as women typically are.
Right, because it's Phryne's point of view, and she that's what she wants, that's what she likes, so you get sort of her gaze at those points. Yeah,
that's right. Mm-hmm. Well, I think we may have we've drawn a bow around the very lovely Miss Fisher, and I was so happy to have a group of people to talk about with the show, because I don't know enough people who, I mean, a lot of people watch it. I don't know enough people who watch it. So hopefully we'll have encouraged more people to watch the show and read the books, and we'll come back and do, you know, a season 2-3 episode at some point in the future. And we can talk about when everyone's caught up with those and then see what's coming out from the Greenwood Machine. I also love, I read a little bit about Carrie Greenwood. She's awesome. She is like totally her own person. Her husband is like a wizard or something? He's a warlock.
Partner. I don't think they're married.
Oh, I'm sorry, right. Isn't he a warlock or something? He's got like this, and it's, they just sound awesome. And she's just this, seems to me this totally down to earth, totally awesome person who just is so like not the person I'd expect to have written it. It was great.
Yeah. I would say, I really, she seems like a delightful person. I really enjoy her writing through the Miss Fisher books. I have, she actually writes at two other mystery series, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
One of them is your classic cozy mystery where the person who keeps solving the crimes is a cook or a restaurateur. So of course all of the titles and all of the plots, I assume, have something to do with cooking or something to do with food. And then there's another one that I may be like a way back historical in ancient Egyptian times, yeah. But I may be totally wrong.
No, it is. It is Egyptian. Yeah.
Yeah. And I would say, yeah, I'm totally have been enjoying reading Greenwood. I would say my only criticism of her as a general thing in her writing is it feels like she wants to show her work a little too much when it comes to specializations in, like, you know, Franny has to learn about X, Y, or Z as part of the investigation. And there's so much detail sometimes. Greenwood is making it absolutely clear. I researched this. Appreciate it.
She's a defense lawyer, huh?
I found the thing about her husband, or partner rather, sorry, that never want to marry, never want to have kids. says his name is, oops, I'm missing the name here. It's David Gregg, and he is a registered wizard, mathematician, author, also a registered wizard by the name of Wizard David, who ran for the federal seat of Kuyung. It's awesome.
This is awesome.
I love it. It's just like, it's like even more, I mean, I would expect like a, oh, I don't know, you know, you think about some of the fancy romance authors, and I was thinking maybe this woman's in this vein, and I'm like, nope, she's just this totally regular person who wears oversized shirts and is just has great time.
Can we briefly
totally regular person with a wizard for a partner?
Exactly. Yeah.
I bet he's very pretty.
He's got a big beard. They've been together for a long time. 39 years. Well, I'm sorry, now it's like 43 years based on the art of destiny. All right. Well, folks, thank you. Thanks. And we thank everybody for joining, for being on this panel. Thank you, Katie. Glad to have you.
Thank you so much for having, for letting me join in this fun. This was Bonza.
Very good. Pleasure. Susie, thank you for your inaugural outing.
Totally fun. Thank you, guys. It was great.
Jean, thank you. I know you have a busy schedule, and thank you for making time during all your travels.
Thank you for making the time one that I could come to, because yes, I was really interested to hear what everybody, you know, was going to bring to this, because it is, like I said, I'm pretty blown away at how much people love this show books. So cool. It was really cool to hang out with you all.
Well, the universe coordinated it, because it was the best time. So obviously it was the right time to do it. And Shannon, thank you once again for being on.
Thank you for indulging my topic.
Oh, it's
I had great fun.
So great. We've got some more stuff in the can. We're still doing some editing on some other shows. This will you'll probably be hearing this episode before or after the one about kids' books mysteries and Columbo. Mm-hmm. So somewhere in the order of folks listening to this, if the others aren't out yet, expect them. If not, go back and check our back catalog out at afootcast.com, and it'll take you to the right spot. I've been Glenn Fleischman, and remain such for now. That's the great mystery. How long shall I remain that? And this has been the Afoot Podcast. Thanks for joining us, and we'll be back again.